Being a technology minister right now is hard. The information space is overwhelmed with contradicting policy recommendations. Timelines are uncertain, and AI is a new technology. So we're in uncharted territory, and there are not specific examples from history or other countries that decision makers can lean on for guidance. Policymakers in developing countries in particular face a huge number of trade-offs when making decisions about AI and technology. They are having to make decisions with little evidence, limited government resources, and high opportunity costs to the investments that they do decide to make. They also face a geopolitical landscape that could one day place large barriers on their access to leading AI models. Welcome to Ideas in Development. I'm Oliver Hanney, the managing editor here at VoxDev. In this series, we're exploring how AI is reshaping development. In this episode, we'll focus on what low and middle-income countries should do right now to capture the benefits of AI. We'll explore why the real bottleneck for developing countries may not be the models themselves, but rather the data that they need, and how ministers can navigate decisions about what to invest in under constraints. To guide us through this conversation, we are joined by Umar Saif, who has been on both sides of the issue, as a tech entrepreneur and as a government minister. Umar, you've had quite a unique path from academia to working in government in Punjab, where you digitized government systems, then becoming Pakistan's federal minister for science and technology and also IT minister. And now you're running an AI company. Going back to earlier in your career, what did digitizing Punjab's government teach you about what countries actually need before AI systems can be useful?
Well, thank you for inviting me. And this is interesting. And thank you for setting up this conversation the way you have. I think you're spot on. We are in uncharted territory. And a lot of policymakers, government ministers, bureaucrats know about this nebulous concept of some AI revolution coming, some artificial generative intelligence that's about to happen. But no one really kind of knows what the contours of that's going to look like. And so I think it's perfectly timed in that way. Now, my take on this is that when I was working in the government, technology was hardly the challenge. It was always kind of the political economy, the bureaucratic friction, political will, appetite for reform, that were kind of the big challenges I had to overcome. So for instance, if you wanted to digitize land records, that's been historically a big problem in countries like Pakistan, post-colonial countries. It's not clear who owns which land, how much. Where that's mapped, is the title of that land indeed in your name or not, and so on and so forth. So digitizing some of that record is an obvious thing to do. Government also gives a fair amount of subsidy to the farmers. It's an agriculture economy, and a large part of the vote bank in this country of politicians come from rural areas largely. So it makes sense to do something for the rural landowners or farmers. Now, the question is, would digitizing land records help that effort or not? One, digitizing it would highlight discrepancies in data or ownership. And at times, it's the local elite, the local feudal lord, who benefits from that information arbitrage. And that feudal lord or that local elite also happens to be a politician in most cases. So therefore, you wouldn't find champions at the local, kind of second-tier local political level, because they will likely not benefit from anything getting digitized for that transparency to come in or for that accountability to come in. So they would kind of resist that. Also, the incumbent bureaucracy would oppose that because they have this unique power of holding on to your land asset. And they have this. They have the final authority literally locked up in a bag of a grade four bureaucrat called a patwari, and your entire kind of, you know, wealth or generational wealth or well-being depends on your goodwill with this bureaucrat who could change that document, can choose not to give you that document. Large bribes are given just to get access to your tool ownership record of your land called a firth. So while the citizen really wanted this to happen, the political economy as well as the bureaucracy would oppose this tooth and nail. So that was the challenge. The challenge wasn't making a computer system and a large database of records. That was pretty off the shelf. But kind of the real challenge was convincing kind of these two big stakeholders that we really need to do it. Of course, the top politician in the province, because he eventually has to go back to elections, and if he did something for his rural vote bank, would support him, wanted this done. So therefore, the first tier political leadership could turn this into a political slogan for their large rural vote bank, but the second tier local politician would see that as their as something that might disrupt their political economy. So that's kind of that I thought was the biggest challenge. So the challenge was never really the technology; it was always the adoption of that technology, who benefits from it, and how would it fit into the larger political economy and appetite of decision makers to bring in a reform like that.
And when this data existed for the first time in a system that had previously been paper-based, what exactly changed?
So I have some very interesting anecdotes from the time that we were able to digitize interesting government records. So for instance, when we digitized land records, we digitized also the record of where the crop is being cultivated, how much crop you will get, for instance, for something like wheat. Now, the wheat crop is an important crop because government treats that as food security and actually buys back crop from the farmer at a slightly higher rate than the market rate. And the method for doing that is to distribute bags called a bardana to the farmer so they can fill up those bags with their wheat, and the government would procure these bags full of wheat from these farmers. Now, the elite capture is such that this slightly higher price that the market price never really trickles down to the farmer because the local elite monopolizes that system. In fact, at the time of procurement of bardana or crop from the farmer, suddenly and miraculously, the cultivable land in Punjab would increase by 20% in that crop cycle. And only we found out only when the record was digitized and were then able to address that, make it such that we capture biometrics of potential farmers before issuing it, rather than to a large landowner who's manipulated these records such that he can be the custodian for the bardana, for those bags, and could benefit from that arbitrage that the government was willing to pay to the farmer to buy back wheat. So likewise, I remember sitting in one of the government's meeting on vaccinations. As you know, Pakistan happens to be one of the few countries in the world that still has polio. And the reason that happens is because of our extended program on immunization, where we are supposed to vaccinate children at various times in their life cycle. As a state, we fail to do it. And that eventually either manifests itself as an outbreak of something like measles or something like polio and other diseases. So there are a lot of vaccine-preventable diseases that would show up in hospitals otherwise. Now, you know, and WHOs and the World Banks and all of our development partners had been crying hoarse that your vaccination program is not working well. That's why you have to run special programs for polio. But the government would not listen. So then we digitized the vaccination records. And if we digitized it such that the vaccinator would have to log every individual vaccination that they do, the location of that vaccination with some unique ID, et cetera, et cetera. And as soon as we began to collect that data, because we were capturing the GPS of the place where the vaccination was done, and as soon as we put it on a map, we realized that there was only 18% geographic coverage of Punjab in terms of vaccinations, only 18, so less than 20%. So 80% geographically, Punjab was not vaccinated. And Punjab, it was a country, would kind of be the ninth largest or 10th largest in the world based, you know, depending on how you look at the population. And that was a stark reminder of myths living in government where they believe they're doing an adequate job of vaccinating children. But as soon as you digitize that data, put it on a map and compare it to the underlying population using some geospatial analysis, you realize that, you know, something like 80% geographically population is missed out from government vaccinations, and so on and so forth. So as soon as you make data digital, as soon as you're able to analyze that data, things become transparent and accountable. And that's, I think also, as I said earlier, is also the real challenge. The real challenge is data and technology, and we'll move on to AI shortly, bring in transparency. They lower the barriers for accountability. They make information publicly widely available. And hence, politicians and more so bureaucracy typically pushes back. And for a government minister wanting to bring in reform as an IT minister or reform minister, that is typically the largest challenge. The other challenge, and it is politically incorrect to say, but let me say that because I didn't say it in response to your first question, is large corporations selling very expensive enterprise licenses to technology that's not going to solve development challenges of this part of the world. So buying a license to a super expensive database or some licensed version of some workflow automation tool or some very expensive ERP is not going to solve the challenge of not maintaining records every 6 months or every crop cycle. For that, you don't need an expensive database. You just need political will and a fairly simple, off-the-shelf, cheap, open-source software system that is able to do it. So kind of the three challenges as a minister that I ran into was of course, the local politicians pushing back on some reforms, the bureaucracy certainly pushing back because they are the main beneficiaries of this arbitrage of information or opacity of processes. And third, large international corporations wanting to sell very expensive technology for e-government, right? God knows what that means. And one has to kind of almost on a daily basis fight all three to bring in some small, simple reform that would finally move the needle on something like vaccinations or school enrollments or corruption-free procurements or ghost teachers or their elimination or making sure that the medicine that the government buys is not sold off in the market, actually reaches the patients, that the government is able to collect taxes from people that short, and so on and so forth.
You've described there a theme that kind of ties into the word or the phrase that you've used to describe many parts of the world, which is data deserts. And some of what you've just talked about shows why that's such a problem for governments. For example, them not understanding actually how many people have been vaccinated or where, when processes aren't digitized. I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about what it means to be a data desert in practice for other actors, specifically kind of companies, also aid organizations as well.
Indeed. I think when I was in the government and now kind of working and collaborating with many donor and aid organizations, I feel there's a huge kind of information arbitrage. There's always this tendency to kind of take a case study or something that worked elsewhere, and AI being sort of this new bright that everyone wants to bring home without kind of fully recognizing or realizing the real challenges of the developing world, where, a lot of data that you require for decision-making, training IT system, AI systems, using them effectively in decision-making, none of that exists. Data is religiously guarded, sits in silos, mostly in paper-based files with layers of bureaucracy on top. And therefore, taking a solution that works elsewhere and kind of trying to import it here would likely not work. And we've seen this day in and day out. And therefore, kind of my favorite book to read is this digital heresy book that my friend Kentaro has written, and on how technology, data, AI actually accentuates inequalities and inefficiencies in a country like Pakistan or in other developing countries, as opposed to address it, unless it's really thought through. And I used to argue with him that, hey, all these things that we've done in Pakistan seem to be working, But you know, but in the kind of the fine print there is that it never worked the way a kind of a Harvard case study would tell you. It always worked by really sitting down, thinking through the problem, and making sure that the real stakeholders are warmed up, be it the citizens or the politicians, the bureaucracy, to actually use that technology. And I do want to say one important thing. I think if you wanted, for instance, vaccination records to be maintained on a laptop, no one's going to do it. One, this device would have to be lugged to a remote village. Someone would need to find some uninterrupted power to keep the device running. Not always possible. Someone would need to find some internet to connect this device to. Not always possible. And then someone would need to learn kind of, you know, how to use, how to type, how to kind of maintain a software system to maintain records for vaccinations. And I wouldn't have been able to kind of make that happen unless they were cheaply available smartphones that kind of solved all these problems in tandem. Now, we take the smartphone for granted, but it has a battery built in. It has a GPS built in. It has a camera. It has a speaker and a mic. You could touch the screen. You could use apps very differently to the ones that you would use on a desktop. So for me, that was kind of the big enabling factor for a vaccinator to carry their phone, click on five things, take a picture of something, and be done with kind of the data that I needed for vaccinations. Same for land records, same for medicine procurement, et cetera, et cetera. For instance, if you wanted a stamp paper to be verified, stamp paper is a paper that's used for writing property transactions, and a lot of them are done on fake, bad-grade stamp papers, always challenged in court. So, you know, you could print a QR code on that paper, but it's, of course, impossible to validate on the go in the street unless you had a phone that could, you know, scan something like a QR code to make sure that the paper is exactly what it says it is. So the phone that we take for granted in your neck of the woods actually enabled a lot of things for folks like me here that otherwise would have been impossible, which leads us kind of to the next question, that is AI at the same kind of inflection point where smartphones, advent of $80 smartphones were many years ago when I began to use Duocam GovTech. And the phone kind of became my main platform through which I could roll out a lot of things that otherwise were very difficult to do on enterprise expensive desktop systems. That was the main reason for success. It wasn't as much as, you know, better technology or this, it was just a better platform that enabled it.
Thinking practically, what are some of the interventions that you feel AI could enable in a country like Pakistan?
There are many things that AI would enable, and I can give you examples. So for instance, in Pakistan's an agriculture economy, but no one really knows how much wheat will we have this year, how much rice will we have this year, how much cotton will the country produce. And our exports are almost tied to our cotton production, which then feeds into the textile industry, which largely runs most of the economy here. Now, imagine living in a country which is largely dependent on one crop, cotton, and not knowing whether that crop is doing well or not. And I remember sitting in a government meeting, and the agriculture secretary came into that meeting. Towards the end of that meeting, I still vividly recall it, and he said, "I have some bad news for you, and that's our cotton crop got destroyed." I'm like, "How did that happen?" So like, it's an old seed. There was sort of this special pest that we didn't account for, and hey, we have had, you know, the entire crop got destroyed. And that's the year Pakistan had a negative growth in textiles, and it impacts the entire economy. And I kept wondering, it should be possible to be able to kind of figure out before that happens if that was going to happen. And of course, there are lots of crop yield prediction models. And at the time, I didn't have enough satellite imagery to work with, but shortly after, Sentinel-2A, which is European Satellite Agency's multispectral imagery, became freely available at a high frequency, high resolution. And using that, one could do better crop prediction. So we started building crop prediction models. Now, the models were pretty off the shelf. You know, we, of course, didn't start training crop prediction models. But we had data to be used for these models. And we, of course, needed to have compute that would run it at Punjab scale overnight. So we know kind of, you know, what the crop yield is going to look like. So therefore, kind of the two things that enabled it was, one, data, two, being able to run these models, but then we didn't need to run them locally. It could run in a cloud or some hybrid, and AI, which was the early models of AI that was doing this, and enabled us to do that. And same you could apply to some, it's on your tax collection. So Pakistan has wealth of data. Every citizen has a biometrically tied national ID, which is linked to every asset that we own and every large expenditure we do. So whether you want to buy a property or a car, enroll your children in college or travel abroad or buy an airline ticket or whatever, everything, or open a bank account, everything is tied to that national ID. No one would imagine in a country like Pakistan, where everything is tied to a biometrically verified national ID, which is tied to every land that you're going to buy, every bank account you'll open, every car, every big thing that you do is tied to this one ID. You shouldn't have any tax evasion. Your tax to GDP ratio should be high. The number of people who are paying taxes should be very high. Except that's one of the worst in the world. And that's not because, you know, now in this case, the biometric ID doesn't exist. That data exists. It's not because the data about car ownership or data about land ownership or who owns a house or what your electricity bill is, what your cell phone bill is, all of that tied to a national ID card exists, except that it exists in religiously guarded silos by various vertical bureaucracies not willing to talk to each other. And I've had a stab at that problem as a provincial minister, because I was custodian for some data sets here, as a federal minister wanting the tax authorities to talk to this and that, and couldn't make it happen. And of course, if you had all this wealth of data about every asset that I own and every expenditure that I make, an AI model can do with a high degree of accuracy some prediction of the income that I would have, and hence the tax that I should be paying. But you've not been able to do that in Pakistan. So the problem is not AI as much as it is the availability of data and for these data silos to finally begin to talk to each other. And that's where I think the national AI policies, et cetera, would play their part. National AI policy would enable, other than the obvious things like, you know, let's put some data center together. But, and I know you might have subsequent questions of data centers also. But, you know, so in a country like Pakistan, we have 27,000 megawatts of installed capacity, but we can only evacuate about 21,000 megawatts. That's not unique to Pakistan. Every country has spare power generation capacity, more than what the power grid or the power infrastructure is able to carry or able to carry feasibly, because it will be too difficult, too expensive to carry it. If that's the case, then there might be a case for having data centers that are co-located or put next to power sources, whether there's hydel or solar or whatever, so that you can use that power locally without putting it in the transmission cables. And as long as you keep the unit economics in a certain way, a lot of applications become very feasible. So maybe, you know, there's case for doing such data centers. But hey, if history's taught us anything, it is not to invest in buying lots of computers, but instead use something that's in the cloud. It is not to begin to invest in infrastructure that you could centrally procure, maintain, and enable, and is always cheaper and better and more reliable, like a data center elsewhere, run by a superscaler, as opposed to putting in 2,000 data centers in a country like Pakistan, where half the villages don't have electricity. So that's kind of, I think those are the challenges that one needs to think about as an AI minister, as a tech minister. So one is kind of the obvious thing to put in data centers. Most AI ministers or ICT ministers that you would go to are thinking about putting in bazillions of dollars in putting data centers. Some are even putting together technology parks. You know, that's also an obvious mistake to make for technology ministers, because it sounds so cool that you're going to put together a technology park and it looks so good that there's a tangible thing you can point to and you can run this in your TV ads and so on. But God knows how a technology park is going to make a country kind of, you know, progress faster, unless you do your tax subsidies in certain ways. And then there's a case for doing kind of better taxation in any case, rather than doing it in just small pieces of plots. So that's so there's technology parks, there's data centers. These are obvious mistakes to make. The next one, of course, is to assume that AI will magically do everything for you without availability of data, and not making policy such that that data is available and is ready to be used by AI systems.
Going back to the start of your answer, I think it's really interesting to learn how data is both this big constraint when we're thinking about AI, but that AI itself can also help to create new data by analyzing satellite imagery or extracting text from paper documents. You've also touched there on AI policy. How should education, training, human capital fit into that conversation?
One, of course, thing that you can't go wrong with is to retool or train your manpower to use AI systems. But a deeper issue there is that you'll have massive, massive unemployment in countries like Pakistan once AI finally happens. So in my field, I'm a software, I write code. I find it therapeutic. I still write code. I guess most MIT people you run into would give you that. Most people listen to music, read code. So I code, but I'm beginning to code less and less because there's so many good tools out there and I keep experimenting with them. And some of them are scary good. You know, they are very, very good at writing code and optimizing code. And at times I just have to write some skeletal code and give it to this AI agent or this AI platform. It does a pretty decent job writing that code. So I think software engineering is going to get disrupted, but also once AI learns to write code, it's going to write better AI. So therefore, there's a recursive improving loop that they've put these things in, where if I've written a generative AI platform, it would self-improve in the sense that you could have it improve itself. That's what it's designed to do. But once these things begin to happen, you'll get disruption with medical care, even though there might be legal issues on whether you can seek medical advice for writing prescriptions or not. But I think the advice would be just as good as a medical doctor. You would likely go less and less to lawyers, at least paralegals, because AI will do a large part of that. You'll likely not use accountants or logo designers. You will not use people who can translate for you. These were the kind of Fiverr Upwork jobs that economies like Pakistan used to feed off of. Design this logo for $5. Proofread this document for me, generate a 400-word document, SEO-ready document for me that I can use on my website, take $200, write a mobile app for me, etc. That's all going to go away, or maintain my ledgers remotely, or etc. Or can you get like a cheap radiologist in a country like Pakistan who can read radiology tests and do some early diagnosis for you? And so all of that is going to be done by AI. Yeah, there's no question that won't happen. I had a medical appointment earlier today, and the doctor just returned from the US, American board certified, and kind of his only defense was that surgeons still continue to do what they do because robots are not going to replace all of that shot. But I guess all the jobs that you would have for the masses in developing countries because of the labor arbitrage that they used to benefit from will likely get automated. Now, the cost for AI immediately might be high, so that offset may not happen immediately, where, you know, if you, for instance, if you give something to, of course, something like ChatGPT or OpenAI, whatever, or any other kind of AI model, the cost for running that is high right now. So if you did, if you Googled something versus you asked a generative AI platform the same question, just the power usage is orders of magnitude different, right? So sure, there's a cost element to this, but eventually you'll be able to run fairly well-trained and optimized foundational frontier models on your desktop and one day on your phone. And you'll be able to converse to them, you know, in a language of your choice, and they'll go out and do things for you that you would want your accountant or your paralegal or whatever had to do, or your software developer had to do. So I think as a IT minister, the one person I want to talk to is the finance minister, because you know the unemployment is going to go through the roof shortly, everywhere, but certainly in countries like Pakistan. And no retooling of the HR, unfortunately, is going to fix it. And that's the honest truth. You go to all these conferences, you meet all these big politicians and so on and so on. So we are going to retrain our workforce to become AI ready. There's no such thing. You know, AI is going to do things that they were traditionally taught in school or in college. I can't think of a skill that AI would not have. You know, what would you teach? You know, these kids that would make them AI ready when AI is able to do a lot of these tasks. So you'll get massive unemployment, and hence countries need to begin thinking about, you know, minimum wage, and think about economic structures that would sustain what's about to happen. About to happen is 3 to 5 years. You know, a lot of these kind of repetitive 5 to 30 minute tasks that people used to do to keep themselves busy and to make a living and for the government to tax that living to run the economy, that model might change. So that, I think, is, for me, that's the kind of the most fundamental part of this discussion.
I guess your career kind of seems to have a bit of a through line that's relevant here, where often what you've worked on has involved adapting technology to local constraints, whether that was the speech-based platform that you created or your research on EdTech, where you were kind of trying to figure out how best to use technology in Pakistan's classrooms. I was wondering if the current AI for development debate seems to be thinking enough about how to adapt AI and the kind of uses of AI to contexts like Pakistan.
I think there's a lot of discussion on two threads. There's, of course, this discussion of having AI systems that are not biased with data or when they're being trained. That does not include a kind of localized context. So there's a lot of discussion around AI with bias or AI that's inclusive because it has data and examples and training from local context. So I think there's a lot of discussion around that. The second discussion that's happening is, of course, access to AI and whether this would solve kind of development challenges. So let me give you an example. For instance, in a country like Pakistan, we have multi-grade classrooms. Multi-grade classrooms would mean that there are children at various levels of education, grade 3, grade 4, grade 6, all in the same classroom, taught by that one teacher in the hours that you give to the school. Because of the shortage of rooms and shortage of teachers, and also shortage of children, you know, there's kind of, you know, in a village, you get a whole collection of kids with various learning abilities and various levels of education that they've received all in one classroom. So how do you teach them? So, you know, of course, one thing that AI enables in this case is personalized learning paths. And there's a lot of research and a lot of discussion around this. And it was kind of, it was mostly in research papers and mostly a topic that everyone talked about, that AI would personalize your learning path for you. But now take that and put that in a multi-grade classroom environment in a country like Pakistan, where if you had 20 kids, they'll all be put in 3 different buckets by AI. And these 3 buckets would be on their own individualized kind of learning paths, so that it's not one teacher either teaching kind of the lowest denominator or the highest grade level, because otherwise what would they do? But in this case, kids would actually catch up, would actually begin to learn and so on. And this multi-classroom, multi-grade classroom environment that you have prevalent in many developing countries would actually become an environment where you put kids begin to learn based on their learning ability and their grade level and so on. So AI would enable that. Now, the question is, I'm just imagining that, you know, that certainly could happen. That's a great outcome of AI. But is it feasible? And how would that happen? So would it happen by kids holding a smartphone in their hand and responding to questions and participating in quizzes and AI kind of suggesting things for them to read and learn based on what it is learning about their learning path? Or would it be a teacher that asks you to carry out a certain exercise and then kind of helps you kind of navigate a more personalized path? So I don't know how it's going to play out, but would AI be cheap enough for 13 million kids to use it in a country like Pakistan? Would it require localized data centers trained on localized textbooks? Would it invariably require that? Maybe it would. So therefore, if you're an IT minister, education minister, I think moving to personalized learning paths for multi-grade classroom environments is an important challenge to solve. It would certainly improve their learning outcomes. Equipping them with smartphones is probably a good idea. But making sure that the phones are actually used in the way that you anticipated is a challenge and a half. We've been down that path. When I was at MIT, there was a one laptop per child or one tablet per child, whatever. And the data around that is kind of doesn't entirely support the imagined outcome at the time. So is that hardware going to be used that way? Now there is certainly software that would enable a vision like that, where every kid is equipped with some technology so that that becomes their personal tutor. Would that require an enormously expensive, power-hungry data center somewhere with lots of GPUs, running 13 million learning paths for 13 million kids? Maybe. Would that become affordable and feasible soon? Perhaps. Can we do that in Pakistan? I don't know. But that's I think that's a tangible example of what AI can enable and the kind of challenges one would need to overcome to enable something like this. In the past, what we've learned is that taking some cool concept or technology from elsewhere and trying to transplant it in countries like Pakistan really has worked. So for instance, a lot of people, of course, can't read and write. And therefore, once we took services like from Reddit or Quora or whatever, and imagined them being used by people who can't read and write, can you just call a system, ask a question, have someone answer it? So most of the early voice-based systems that we had were voice-based community systems where voice was your way to interact, but some human was engaging with you. So these became little social networks that where people were engaging, but as internet of oral, so to speak, what we used to call it. But now it doesn't need to be a human on the other side. You could actually ask an AI system a question, and the AI system could actually respond without. So that could be your local caregiver, could be your local health worker, at least telling you when your next vaccination is due, at least telling you what you should be doing in your prenatal cycle right now. It could at least tell you if your child has diarrhea that you should rush them to a hospital. So I think that triage, that local health worker's role, could actually be an AI on your phone doing it for you, as long as you don't require too much literacy or technology savviness to use it. And I think speech would have some role to play there. Maybe your camera would have some role to play there, and so on and so forth. But I think AI would enable a lot of things that we've always wanted to do in ICT for development or AI for development or technology for development, because it finally enables a lot of that. Except that I don't know how feasible it is in the short term to do that. And maybe a phone is your best ally there. Maybe it'll be some trinket or locket or some variable. I don't know, or your glasses, how that's going to get enabled. But I think it'll be the problems would need to, the problems of the developing sector are ripe to be used by an AI paralegal, an AI local health worker, an AI teacher. And I think I can imagine them to be not contrived examples anymore. These are very real. You could really make that happen tomorrow, as long as you figure out who's going to run these expensive, power-hungry data centers and who's going to support them.
Yeah, and getting on to that, so you said there that you're not sure it's feasible in the short term, but a lot of policymakers right now will be thinking, okay, how do I get there in the medium term or the long term as quickly as possible, essentially. And one thing we're hearing in a lot of those debates is that countries will say they need their kind of own sovereign AI capacity. The word sovereignty comes up a lot in these discussions. You, a minister who kind of would have had to decide whether to fund something like that, how to approach it, do you think that's a good use of limited resources, or is it somewhat of a distraction?
Well, so I don't know what sovereignty means. So that typically is, you need to unbundle that a little bit. So there is this whole discussion on data security. For instance, look at EU, and they have a lot of kind of, I think on this spectrum, they would be on this side of that spectrum in terms of laws that they have. Privacy laws, consumer data, what stays inside their jurisdiction, what goes out, et cetera, et cetera. So they want to, you know, really maintain that geographic sovereignty in terms of where data resides, who can touch it, what data you're allowed to store what data you can use to target people with ads and services. So I think there's a fair bit of that that EU has done. Now, there are lots of other countries that have taken other stabs at this sovereignty equation. So there's data privacy security discussion. I get that. There's this whole discussion of whether every country can have their own semiconductors. I don't think that's going to happen. So if your sovereignty depends on having your own semiconductors, I think that's not going to happen. However, if your sovereignty also depends on training a frontier model, I doubt that's going to happen also. And if your sovereignty happens on enormously large compute power, think Google-scale data centers, OpenAI-scale data centers, orbital data centers, whatever they're doing these days, I don't think that's going to happen also. And also, the question is, with limited resources and challenges, would having a local data center or investing all those resources and time in somehow leveraging an existing model in some feasible way where children grades in primary grade levels in multi-grade classrooms in rural areas would be able to access it, train that those models, fine-tune those models, build a RAG architecture using local textbook data so that they could actually effectively use it, train your teachers to how to kind of now seamlessly go back and forth with an individualized tutor that we could get you on a student's handphone. I think kind of those are the kind of things that I think are worth wrestling with, as opposed to kind of this imagination of a digital sovereignty where people want to train their own AI systems or have their semiconductor supply chain entirely in their control. I don't think that's possible. I think there'll be, of course, there's, at a minimal level, for the defense tech or, you need some supply of semiconductors and some tie into one of the two or three supply chains that are being currently, siloed globally. So you need to tie yourself with one of the supply chains for semiconductors, for GPUs, for AI models. But, with these open weight, open source AI models, we use quite a few of them. And we historically had used sort of open source versions from largely the US. But recently, the data science team we have in the company have begun to look at open weights models from China. And they're just as good and they're open weight. So there's a lot that they could do with that. And the joke is that in the US, the models are not open weights. So you have to hire people from one company to the other for those weights to spread around on very expensive salaries. But another way to do it is to make the weights open. So I guess fast forward 5 years. So that's maybe one good way to frame this. Fast forward 5 years. I think open weights, open source, very efficient, which means big train models compressed into what really matters. So very efficient models that you could run locally, perhaps on your phone, would have happened. So that's one. You need to make sure that you could use those models with your local context, either by fine-tuning, giving it local context or access to data that it needs to churn out the responses that you need. So I think as an AI minister, you want to make sure your data is in a shape that you could use these models effectively. Two, I think you need some data centers, especially in models where there's excess capacity that the government is paying for that capacity to exist there, but not effectively using. So I think there's case for doing that. There's certainly case for training people to use AI more effectively. So if you are in a med school, this is time for you to really embrace AI, as opposed to treat it as your enemy. If you're in the law school, really learn to use AI the best way you can. I think we were together at a Harvard conference a little while ago, and I was very curious on, how these MBAs are going to exist with AI. And at least the Harvard Business School had entirely embraced the use of AI. So all the case studies that they gave us was mandated that we used a generative AI platform to wrestle with the data, to come up with hypotheses, and to make these presentations. And therefore, I think there's a lot of fields and a lot of skills and traits that would need to be retooled to use AI. And because they will get retooled that way, there'll be fewer and fewer of those technically skilled people needed for that job. You'll need fewer paramedics. You'll need fewer paralegals. You'll need fewer accountants and so on and so forth. And what they're going to do is The other big question that countries like Pakistan, but elsewhere also, need to think about that. So the whole model of taxing labor to run your economy is going to get questioned. That, I think, is the big element.
Yeah, and you spoke a bit there about Harvard last year. And I guess one of my takeaways then was that at the time, you seemed quite pessimistic about AI's potential in low middle-income countries. And it strikes me that today your tone is certainly a lot more, I would say, optimistic in terms of what the models are capable of, even if that might have these negative labor market outcomes. I was wondering if there's anything specifically you've seen in your work or what you've been reading in the past year that's kind of led to this change or speeding up of the timelines you have in mind.
Two things. One, I remain skeptic in the sense that I think the cost of running AI is too high. It's not going to be feasible in the next 5 years or so. But I am kind of trying to frame these conversations fast forward 5 years. And these models have all come along. They're open weights, open source. You can fine tune them. You can run them locally on your machine. If that was the case, the applications they would enable would finally begin to solve, historic big development challenges like learning outcomes for students in multi-grade classrooms, like doing better taxation systems by being able to ascertain how much tax someone should pay, like being able to do crop yield prediction before a disaster happens, by being able to do forecasting of floods and disasters before they happen. And there's an AI-based one that's just come out from Google, by the way. Great Nature paper happened 2024. I've now looked at that model. Much better than any previous model we had for flood prediction, where you needed a lot of gauges and a lot of data. Once these models are trained, they can live with very sparse data to be able to do very good predictions. The cost will be high, but the real challenge would be for people to see this as an ally in what they do. If they see this as an adversary, that's going to make them redundant or will erode their power or will erode their elite capture. They would push back. That was my experience with technology, and that's certainly what's going to happen with AI. I was in a conference where one of the systems digitized was for the courts there, the judicial courts. And judges are, of course, among other things, have big egos because they decide legal cases. You address them with a lot of... And in that discussion, I picked up that a lot of them have begun to write their final judgments using AI. And because their tone was such with each other, where they were insinuating that half of them and maybe all of them had finally begun to write their judgments using AI. So judges who couldn't string together two sentences of English were writing these beautifully crafted judgments of 50 pages overnight, and that happened because of AI. So now the question is, but no one's going to admit. Left to them, they would not acknowledge. And maybe they shouldn't be doing it. Maybe they should. I don't know. The lawyer could be an AI lawyer. The judge could be an AI judge. And I certainly saw that play out. There was a lot of discussion. And it's a precedence-based legal system, much like the UK that we have in Pakistan. If it's been decided such in the past, then that precedence would hold. Now, imagine how good AI would be at doing that, right? So, and how eloquently it would put that case together, that judgment together for you, if that's something that you want to do. So sure, but I think the real challenge would come from existing stakeholders, some very powerful ones, eroding their power and their place in society because of AI. And I think more than cost, more than the quality of these models or the strength of these models, it would be the adoption of these models that will hold us back.
To conclude, if we're thinking about what a minister who's listening to this should do right now, is there one single thing that you would want them to take away from this that you think they might not currently kind of understand or have in mind for their job?
I think an AI minister in this part of the world where people do repetitive tasks with some labor arbitrage and that's kind of largely what the export economy, skill-based export economy, is built on. That model is going to get challenged fundamentally very, very soon. Two, I think using AI to solve development challenges, all things that we had imagined could happen. Children can learn on their own, and we could replace the local health worker with an AI agent and so on. And there won't be a property fraud because an AI agent would write your legal property transaction document and so on. I think that's happened. And what I'm beginning to see in these AI models, they're certainly improving much faster than what anyone anticipated. That's what we should have known this looking at history, but I keep getting surprised at how quickly these models are improving. Every new iteration of this model is scary good. So, you know, maybe it is months away from really doing kind of the things that we'd always wanted to do. Now, the question is, what platform would, you know, is it the phone? Is it, how would you make sure that a technology of that sort becomes accessible to people at the bottom of the pyramid? So that's question number one. Question number two, this whole employment model, labor market dynamics are going to change. Three, sure that you should put in some data centers, where you locate them, co-locate them closer to power sources, etc. Big question. But I am kind of I'm not too high on this conversation on digital sovereignty or AI sovereignty, because I think that's a very short-term view. I think in the long term, all of that is going to go away, and models need lots of data to get trained. No one can keep a model caged in a geography or in a country and expect it to perform better than the model. So our models would be out there. Everyone would be training them, testing them, improving them, and that's how you'll have democratized access to AI. And I think that's also a given. The only issue is the cost and accessibility. And as a government minister, I would focus on solving these two problems.
Thank you, Umar. This has been Ideas in Development. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. As always, all previous episodes can be found at voxdev.org.